From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, how massive open online courses are transforming the relationship between universities and the general public. Then astrophysicist Dave Goldberg asks a basic question. In a world of both matter and antimatter, why are we here?
If we always create them in equal quantities and we always destroy them in equal quantities, why haven't they completely canceled each other out in the first few seconds after the Big Bang?
A Milwaukee man's memoir gives us a unique view of growing up in 1960s and 70s New York, and an exhibit showcases a creative response to a land in turmoil, Afghan war rugs.
What fascinates me is the fact that you've got this centuries-old tradition fighting against contemporary reality and contemporary society and really, in a way, very individualistic expression.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. You've probably heard a lot about how distance learning is transforming education. College students take some of their courses while they're in pajamas in their dorm rooms. And virtual high schools exist virtually around Wisconsin, attracting kids who are otherwise left behind by the traditional classroom. But another aspect of virtual education is gaining a foothold as big-name universities extend their brand. Massive open online courses, or MOOCs, allow hundreds or thousands of students to take courses from leading schools around the world, although not typically with an aim toward a traditional college degree. Last month, the Greater Milwaukee Committee brought together several university presidents from the area to discuss the future of MOOCs with national expert Chris Westfall. Westfall joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in the studio then and explained why he felt the time was right for MOOCs.
The idea of time is very interesting. If you take people from different professions, if you had a time machine and you could bring people from 100 years ago, if you could bring a police officer from 1913 into this century, that individual would be completely mystified as to how to do his or her job in the current era. But if you were to bring a professor of Renaissance history to 2013, that individual will be perfectly comfortable in the modern classroom. Of course, there will be some technologies and things that will be a mystery, but essentially the way that education has been delivered, particularly higher education in this country for more than 100 years, there's been no change. And MOOCs, or massive open online courses, represent a tectonic shift in the way that people access education. MOOCs are located at the intersection of commerce, in other words, what businesses expect, what students expect, and what colleges, or at least some colleges, are able to deliver.
Paint a picture of how MOOCs are working. This is still fairly early in the era of MOOCs. What do they look like today, and where do you see them going?
Well, first, to define what a MOOC is, a massive open online course is designed to offer free access to a large student population to a particular skill. And MOOCs actually started in 2011 when Stanford University decided to offer an online course into artificial intelligence. And 160,000 people signed up for the course. So that's where we are right now in terms of what it means is this accessibility. And 23,000 people actually completed that course. So it's given rise to a number of organizations now that offer these online courses. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's sort of a background for
– And there are key – I mean, distance learning, sort of traditional distance learning, has been around for a long time. There are some key differences between a massive open online course and what we think of as traditional distance learning.
Well, there are several, but the key difference is flipping the classroom. In a traditional model, the classroom represents the place for the sage on the stage, if you will, the lecture hall for the professor to share their knowledge. MOOCs flip the classroom in that the lecture is recorded. The lecture is watched and viewed as homework. So what actually happens in the online course is delivered in a shorter format and focuses on greater activity for the students. So it's really an opportunity for one-on-one work, for the actual problem solving to take place. So in that regard, the classroom is flipped. So what we think of as homework has changed, so has what we think of as being in the traditional classroom. And in fact, if you want to know what the traditional classroom is going to look like in the world of MOOCs, you hold it in your hands and it has a flat screen on it and you type on a digital keyboard. That's the world that we're moving to, and that's the way that students want to access knowledge.
Well, how is that one-on-one activity working? Because presumably the university or the college that's offering the course and the person who's really running it isn't going to sit there and grade 130,000 papers.
What's so exciting about MOOCs is that they harness the power of social, and they create an opportunity for students to help students. So there is, as you can imagine, in a group of 160,000, there is an opportunity to create subgroups, study groups, an opportunity to create questions and answers, you know, because students are going to have similar questions. So MOOCs really are about, again, using technology in more meaningful, more compelling ways to take advantage of some of the things that we see in social, like, that, for example, like Facebook groups, but turning that into a platform that helps students to help themselves in a spirit of sharing, which is also behind the whole initiative for MOOCs.
What about quality control? Without, a bricks and mortar advisor there to guide your MOOC education, how are the right would-be students connecting with the right classes?
Well, quite frankly, Mitch, the jury's still out on that. And one of the challenges that MOOCs face is not only in quality control but also cheating. Cheating has been a real problem in the coursework. But there are some things that can be designed into the courses to help. For example, some of the organizations that are offering MOOCs, such as Coursera, Udacity, and others, have online tools to track where students are stumbling. So not only are they able to know where perhaps in a video or in a lesson or in a quiz there are challenges that keep coming up over and over again and actually tweak and adjust their teaching to make it more effective, but they have an opportunity to know in no uncertain terms where students are struggling and provide feedback for things like and even rewards for things like persistence. Because if I turn in an assignment on a math problem, for example, you don't know how many times I tried to solve that problem before I got to the answer I came up with. But if I'm doing that online, guess what? You do. And you can see my challenges in new and more meaningful ways. So it is true that it's difficult for one teacher to address the needs of 10,000 or 100,000 students. But by using these online tools and by using technology, when any media platform gets translated through the internet, it changes. And so that's part of the challenge that we're seeing now for MOOCs is what is that change going to look like and how can we use technology in a more meaningful way so that there can be quality control, there can be standards. And another way that they can inject quality control in there is by offering certifications, in other words, for competency. I mean, it's one thing to take a course, but it's quite another to be able to prove that you can speak Spanish, for example. There needs to be some sort of testing element to prove competency as well.
And so the next step perhaps is the bottom line. What are they getting out of it? Is the idea to have a certified skill set that comes out of it or simply to broaden their education?
I think it's both, but the certified skill set is really the thing that is compelling, at least on the student side. And it creates some challenges for traditional universities as they look at themselves, I believe, as an institution, as they should, not a trade school. So if they are producing MOOCs that provide skills, how do we make sure that we're, as a university, providing critical thinking skills, not just capabilities and sort of trade school sort of things? Not that there's anything wrong with that. But for traditional universities, it can be a challenge. The key is to provide competency, some sort of certification. And we have certifications out there. If you're going to be a lawyer, you have to take the bar exam. A CPA, there are certifications that you have to have. What about similar standards for courses in marketing or nursing, for example? And those certifications, those standards have to be in place in order for MOOCs to be effective. And you ask about the bottom line too. And those certifications are really a place or an opportunity for the revenue model behind MOOCs to take place because, as you remember, MOOCs are a free platform. That's how they're designed. It's, you know, come one, come all. But when it comes time for the certification, that's where there can be charges. And again, there are different business models, and I'm not trying to say that this is a one-size-fits-all because MOOCs are about specificity and creating a specific curriculum for specific needs. But in general, the certification opportunity. And when you're an organization like Khan Academy that has over 4 million users, you know, if they charge even $10 for a certification and only 25% of their student population takes advantage of that, that's still a very, very large number.
And so without certification being a standard part of the equation yet, what are the colleges and universities and other institutions that are offering these courses getting from it? How much of it right now is about brand building?
brand building is really key, and there are universities right here like the University of Wisconsin-Madison that is offering and exploring what it means to provide these programs and other schools in the area as well. So what we're seeing from the thought leaders at Harvard, MIT, Stanford, some of the leaders in this space who dip their toe into the water first is that they view it, I believe, as an opportunity to really establish themselves as the arbiter of knowledge at the top tier level. So it's an opportunity that exists as well for other schools here in Wisconsin and across the country to provide that same sort of thought leadership. And that thought leadership is really what students, I believe, are looking for. I mean, ultimately, there's no replacement for the experience of being on campus, going to football games, going to parties, you know, those kinds of things. But for students and also for the parents who are paying for the students to go to a traditional college experience, ultimately the goal is, what is the credential? What is the capability? What do you have that you didn't have before in terms of critical thinking that can translate into a meaningful contribution in terms of a salary or starting your own business or whatever your goals may be?
And so if the idea isn't necessarily that MOOCs are going to supplant the bricks and mortar education, is it more likely that the people that are going to be pursuing opportunities through these massive open online courses will already have a higher education in their background?
Perhaps. What's changing for the university environment is this concept of lifelong learning. I mean, the idea that a college sophomore is 20 years old is yesterday's news. I mean, that individual could be a 37-year-old mother of two. It could be a 14-year-old prodigy. Who knows? But the market is asking for the ability to access the benefits of a Marquette education, for example, a powerful brand, but to be able to access that from La Crosse or Two Rivers or some other city where you don't necessarily have to be on campus. And what about for the working professional that would like to study and work on problems at 10 o'clock at night or 2 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon? That's the viability and that's the expansiveness that MOOCs can offer. It can't replace the college experience, but what the college experience is changing.
And I would imagine, like anything that really takes advantage of the internet, this entire model could look completely different 5 years from now, 10 years from now.
It's impossible to predict what this model is going to become. In fact, I was talking with someone who I really respect and maybe the listeners need to know about, a guy by the name of Jose Bowen. Jose Bowen is the author of a book called Teaching Naked, and he's the dean of the Meadows School of the Arts at SMU. And he's a friend of mine. And I called him and I said, you know, Jose, what course can't be taught on a MOOC? Can you learn to play the violin, or can you learn to diagnose pleurisy, or can you learn how to draw blood effectively from a massive online course? What can't you learn? And he said, quite frankly, I don't know, and neither does the marketplace. And really what this whole educational initiative means, and it means to the people listening and to the schools here in the Milwaukee area and the state of Wisconsin and beyond, you have to ask yourself, how will you help to define what MOOCs mean? And educators for years have served as curators of content, meaning that as a college professor, you don't necessarily create everything that the students absorb. Even if you've written the textbook, you refer them to resources and that sort of thing. And so as content creators move into content curators, it's education's job to point people in the right direction and to have access to those resources. And the world-class resources define the world-class university, define the world-class education, and MOOCs are yet another resource that people can tap into and provide the kind of accessibility that fits students at all points in their lifetime and at all points in their career.
Chris Westfall, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. It's a pleasure.
Chris Westfall is a national expert on massive open online courses, or MOOCs. He also holds the distinction of being a national elevator pitch champion. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk with area university leaders about MOOCs in an event convened by the Greater Milwaukee Committee. He spoke with Mitch Teich then. Hidden Symmetry is at the heart of why we're all here. We'll learn why that is when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Academics struggle with some pretty big questions depending on their field. Philosophers, for example, might ask, why does anything matter? While for physicists like Dave Goldberg, the question is, why is there matter? Goldberg studies and teaches cosmology at Drexel University in Philadelphia. But when he's not teaching undergraduates, he's trying to make this material comprehensible to everyone. Goldberg is the author of the recent book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror: How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. We reached Goldberg by phone and asked him about one of the most curious ideas that he raises, that we owe our existence to a minus sign.
I think one of the things that people are often surprised by when they learn about science, when they learn about the laws of physics, they see one thing happen after another, and everything sort of seems deterministic, like one of these classic Rube Goldberg machines. But I think one of the problems is that we don't realize how much the universe seems to be fighting against our very existence. And I'll give you an example, the one you're alluding to, which has to do with something that we see called antimatter. We're able to generate it in the lab. People have heard about it from science fiction. It sounds very dangerous because antimatter, when it comes in contact with ordinary matter, completely annihilates. And so one of the strange and sort of surprising things is that in many respects, antimatter is almost exactly the same as ordinary matter, to the degree that if we turned all of your atoms into anti-atoms, as long as we did the same thing to the rest of the universe, then we just wouldn't know the difference. Physics behaves exactly the same.
Okay.
But there's another important part to this. I said that matter and antimatter annihilate. They annihilate completely, one atom for every anti-atom and so on. But we create them the same way. Every time we've been able to create a particle, we create its antiparticle at the same time. So the big question is, if we always create them in equal quantities and we always destroy them in equal quantities, why haven't they completely canceled each other out in the first few seconds after the Big Bang? Why are we left? Why is there matter at all? So matter and antimatter form this great symmetry in the universe, but it turns out that it's not quite perfect. So this little tiny, and literally one part in a billion, this little tiny distinction, one we've never been able to directly replicate in a lab, between matter and antimatter, is literally all that allows you to exist, because otherwise we would have been completely annihilated. There are no anti-people. There are no anti-galaxies, as near as we can tell. There's just us, this tiny little extra bit, basically, in the universe.
So that broken symmetry is something that, again, as I was reading the book, and I am not a physicist, I'm not a scientist, coming to it just out of interest and trying to understand better, you know, the universe that we live in, it seems that broken symmetry is required in a lot of different places in order for things to happen.
That's right. So, I mean, I've already mentioned the symmetry, the asymmetry with regards to matter and antimatter. There's another one that's, I think, important and really surprising, which is that, for the most part, if you do an experiment on a microscopic scale, and you look at all the interactions of particles, and you take a little movie of it, if you run that movie in reverse, basically the flow of time going the opposite direction, that movie looks perfectly valid. The physics looks perfectly fine. And this points to something really kind of weird. As far as the laws of physics are concerned, there is no arrow of time. The laws of physics don't intrinsically know about what is the future and what is the past. So there's a symmetry there, too. And yet, we clearly know that the future and the past are different, just like we know that matter and antimatter are different, and we're the one and not the other. We know which one is the future and not the past. There's a different sort of symmetry breaking, one that we understand, at least, in sort of a very basic way that comes from something known as the second law of thermodynamics, which basically is the idea that things get more complicated over time, or things fall apart, or things become more disordered. And so the big, I guess, fundamental question, one we do not have the answer to, is it that things become more complicated over time, or does the arrow of time go in the direction in which things get more complicated? And we honestly don't know the answer to that.
Do we have any best guesses?
Yeah, a lot of people have best guesses. Unfortunately, for the most part, they generally tend to pick one or the other. Some very, very smart people think that the flow of time, the direction of the flow of time, is caused by the increase in entropy. I must say, I don't share that view. I tend to believe that the direction of the arrow of time is something that's inherent, and then it so happens that entropy increases with time. Entropy is this disorder that I talked about earlier. The reason that entropy increases with time is it's something that's just very, very likely to. You know, you start off with coins, for example. They can either be on heads or tails, and if I have 100 of them, and they're all initially set to heads, and I come along randomly and just start flipping them over one at a time without looking, as time goes on, they'll get distributed more and more, 50-50 heads and tails. They'll become essentially more uniform. Basically, it will increase in entropy. But that's just random chance. So when we're told, you know, in our introductory physics classes that there's this thing called the second law of thermodynamics, the reality is it's actually just a very, very good suggestion, not really a law. It's something that's incredibly likely to happen, that entropy will increase with time. For my money, since it's just something that's very likely to increase with time, ridiculously likely, with many, 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 many zeros, since it's just something that's very likely to increase with time, it's hard for me to imagine a scenario in which time itself is governed by the increase in entropy.
Okay. Well, and telling the stories, one of the things that you talk about in the book are black holes, and you talk about positioning our Alice on the edge of the event horizon on the black hole. And, you know, a lot of us, particularly those of us who love science fiction and, you know, do popular science reading and that sort of thing, you know, love the idea of black holes and want to understand them. And, oh, you know, everything gets sucked into a black hole and that there's all kinds of fun stuff. But you take that and you play with that. And yet after reading that chapter, I understood so much better what's happening at the event horizon, just before the event horizon, in the black hole itself. And I think maybe you're onto something.
Well, first of all, thank you. Those are very kind words. Secondly, for your listeners, you mentioned Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass come up a lot in this book because, of course, Lewis Carroll played around a lot with the idea of how things look in the mirror, obviously, mm-hmm. But also how things look in just slightly different worlds where you change the rules seemingly ever so slightly, and played around with games like chess, but plays around with those ideas of these symmetric games and flipping things around. So Alice ends up being a proxy a lot of the time. But it's absolutely true that you know, trying to sort of imagine yourself in circumstances like falling into a black hole, or how that would appear, or why it would appear that way, and why falling into a black hole really isn't that different than a lot of the physics that we experience every day. It's just more extreme. I think that's a perspective that many people might not have seen before. One of the heroes, in fact, probably the hero of this book, is a little-known mathematician named Emmy Noether.
Yes, and I was going to bring up Emmy Noether because she is probably someone that most of us haven't heard of. I certainly hadn't before I read your book, and it seems that what she did was contributed in a fundamental way to our understanding of physics in the 21st century.
Oh, she absolutely did. So for your listeners who aren't familiar with her, and by the way, you're certainly not alone. I did a poll of Twitter followers and Facebook followers and my own students and even some of my colleagues, and many didn't know who she was or vaguely knew who she was. There are very few who really had sort of committed Noether's theorem to memory, or really understood it, and she's incredibly important. So first, just a quick biography. She's an almost exact contemporary of Einstein. She was not allowed to study at Erlangen, which was the university in her town in Bavaria, actually where her father was even on the faculty. She was only basically allowed to audit classes and had to take a final exam remotely, sort of on her own, a final at the end of her 4 years of education, entirely because she was a woman. Eventually, she'd get her PhD. Having done so, she was invited to Göttingen University to work on her mathematics by some of the giants of the age. But again, because she was a woman, she wasn't there in any official capacity. She wasn't paid. She was allowed to lecture only under somebody else's name. But she produced this incredible, incredible body of work. Mathematicians, I think, revere her. But she's also produced something incredibly important for physicists, and that's this Noether's theorem. And Noether's theorem basically says all these symmetries that I talk about throughout the book, they have real consequences in the real universe. They create conservation laws. And conservation laws are physicists' bread and butter, and they can be explained very simply. You know, suppose you have $50 in your wallet, you spend $10 on lunch, you don't need to look in your wallet again to know how much money you have left, right? The money you took adds up to, and the money that remains adds up to what you started with. And the same is true for lots and lots of quantities like energy, momentum, electric charge. And what Noether did is she basically gave a way of computing, of figuring out what all of the conserved quantities in the universe are. And so if you come up with a new theory, and people do this all the time, people are trying to merge, you know, come up with so-called theories of everything and grand unified theories. If you come up with one of these theories, you basically, they're all built around symmetries. And so Noether basically says, here is exactly how you can figure out all the conserved quantities. It sort of provides the pathway to figuring out new particles, new interactions, and all of that. And it really just stems from this very basic idea that she came up with and developed. Incredibly, incredibly important. And it's an incredible shame that I think she's not better known.
Dave Goldberg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Dave Goldberg's latest book is called The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. He teaches in the physics department at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and his other works include A User's Guide to the Universe. Our interview with him first aired earlier this month. We'll take another break now, and then a Milwaukee man's memoir of growing up in New York in the 60s with his famous writer father. That's coming up when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. The writer Bruce J. Friedman was known to many in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s for novels such as Stern, stage plays such as Scuba Duba, and screenplays like Stir Crazy, Splash, and The Lonely Guy. But to then-aspiring writer Kip Friedman, he was also known as Dad. Friedman's new memoir, Barracuda in the Attic, recalls the distinctive experiences growing up with a literary lion as a parent. We caught up with Friedman in late September before his reading at Boswell Book Company, and he told Mitch Teich then how his memoir fit into the history of his family.
Apparently, the Friedmans have created a cottage industry of family memoirs. My father is a writer and recently had a book called Lucky Bruce about his literary memoir, his life as a writer. My oldest brother, Josh, a few years ago had a book called Black Cracker about his childhood, which was creative nonfiction, which is his own genre.
Right.
I decided to write a book about my childhood, a memoir, accurately bringing back to life some of the highlights, some of the exciting things that happened in my childhood. And for my own purpose, because I had a wonderful, magical childhood, and I wanted to put it back together again. You know, I wanted to have a record for it.
Well, why now? Why was this the right time to do this?
Well, I had time on my hands. I had been working full-time throughout my 30s and into my 40s, and I actually quit my full-time job to become a full-time photographer and part-time publicist. And during that period, I found myself at my computer one winter morning, thinking, if I never write this story, I mean, if I don't have as much time as I do now, I'll never get it written. The story was about a time in my life after my parents divorced in the mid-1970s. I moved in with my father into his duplex apartment in Midtown Manhattan, and we were like two bachelors living together again. He was recently divorced. I was about 16, about a year and a half away from going off to college. So I wanted to recall that magical time in my life. We really had a lot of fun, went on some adventures. I got to see what his life was like as a writer, meeting with people, going on some of his business trips.
Well, and let me jump in. I mean, there's not exactly a story arc to the book, but there are themes you come back to with frequency. And one of them is your parents' on-again, off-again marriage, which in a way really seems to have given you some insight into your dad that you might not otherwise have had.
The story of my parents on-again, off-again relationship, their several separations and eventual divorce was sort of a backdrop in my childhood. My brothers and I were each affected somewhat. I'm not painting a bad picture. My parents gave us a magical, wonderful childhood and put their emphasis on us. They were, if anything, indulgent, allowed us to be very creative. All of us wound up, big surprise, being artists. And so we felt that their dissolution of the marriage was separate somehow from our own childhood, and they made that so. Nevertheless, while I was enjoying my childhood, there was evidence in the background that this was a theme. So that shows up in a lot of my stories, but it's really a series of stories about different aspects of my childhood that were meaningful to me. I talk about my memories of my grandparents, who I bring back to life because I knew them and yet I didn't really know them. So I tried to make sense, literally, out of who they were and what they meant to me. I talk about my relationship with my brothers. Again, they were artists. They're older. My middle brother, Drew, is a famous illustrator, cartoonist. My oldest brother, Josh, is a wonderful musician and writer. He's been published. And I was the youngest brother, so I was kind of swept along following them, whether we were going to pursue the scariest horror movies on 42nd Street and Broadway or to comic book conventions at hotels and convention centers around Manhattan, or even to go to this rustic comic book store we called the Back Issue Store, where just for fun we would be let loose into this warehouse of a store in the middle of Manhattan and find old obscure comic books from the 1940s and 50s, magazines, Mad magazines, the original ones. And my father somehow found out about this place and allowed us to just go there. Most parents would have taken their kids to a movie. My dad was a little more creative.
And you turned into kind of regulars there. I think you're right that the guy that ran the shop was a little skeptical at first, but then kind of got used to seeing you there.
Yeah, not many children went to this back issue store where literally backlogs of magazines were brought to. So to have these three kids running in like bulls into a china shop was a little unique for them. However, because we go there every few weeks or so, they got used to us and we became regular customers. My memories of that warehouse, the mildew, the creaky stairs, plastic smells, the rows and rows of magazines piling up to the sky. It was really quite a magical place to go to, and we got about a half an hour or so to buy whatever we wanted within a budget and then get out of there.
New York obviously figures really heavily in this book. Do you feel like you're not just capturing your own history but maybe providing a snapshot of New York in a certain time in its history?
We were fortunate to be raised in the New York City area in the 1960s and early 1970s. It didn't feel like a big city to us because we just were immersed in New York. There was something almost provincial about it. It still is today, I think, a series of neighborhoods. But by going to different parts of Manhattan, my father's from the Bronx, my mother's from Brooklyn, we felt very familiar and comfortable in a city of 9 million people that apparently never sleeps. After moving away to go to University of Wisconsin-Madison in the late 1970s is when I realized that it was quite a big city. I didn't really experience such a magnitude of a city till after I left it. So I come back to New York City as a tourist. But in the 1970s, it seemed small. It seemed very familiar, personal. You ran into people in neighborhoods. My father's orbit consisted of writers, of actors, producers, directors, playwrights, you name it. And you'd see a lot of these people just walking down the streets. I must have sat next to Woody Allen about three or four times at my dad's writing salon restaurant called The Lanes. It just seemed natural and real. You'd see Tom Wolfe walking down Fifth Avenue with his white outfit with a little carnation or whatever he wore. And you just say hi. I mean, it just seems small to me.
You mentioned your father's writing salon / restaurant. Where does food fit in with the story of your childhood?
Well, food is family. I'm a product of a Jewish family, so Eastern European Jewish family. So food was always there wherever we went. And if you weren't stuffed to the gills, you didn't have a meal. So that went without saying. All the traditional Jewish foods, matzo ball soup, blintzes, you name it. But being in New York City, we were able to experience foods from all over the world. And my father, being a foodie, really enjoyed discovering new types of cuisines. Indian food didn't really become popular until much later. But in the 1970s, it was very unique in New York City. Szechuan food, spicy new flavors that, you know, people weren't used to. Cutting-edge foods, Korean food. We just found food was part of the cultural landscape. It was something you enjoyed, like going to the theater to see an opening night of a play, or to see a great movie. It's to go to the Madison Square Garden and watch the New York Knicks or play in a championship. It was part of everyday life in New York City.
And I think you write that to this day, your father still thinks of you as a soup person, just from that period in your life.
Well, my father, being a writer, embellishes, alters, finds meaning, and makes everything seem special and unique. So growing up, he, of course, picked up on the fact that I love soup. And he would call me a famous soup man. And that went to my head. So I grew up thinking, there must be people that know of me. I'm a famous soup man. And only in retrospect, much years later, that I realized that was his way of just making me feel special and making foods more special than perhaps they really were. He has this habit of, when he sees a restaurant proclaiming to have world-famous waffles on its signage, he'll say, really? I wonder if they're famous in Uganda. You know, and I still do that, and I do that with my son. Still, food has played a major role in our family.
And I gather you passed along your love for hot and sour soup to your son.
I have passed along my love of hot and sour soup to my son. My grandmother introduced it to me at a restaurant called Ruby Foo's in Midtown Manhattan in the mid-1960s. And I was proud to see that my son wrote a seventh-grade essay where he wrote, I consider myself a gourmand of sorts, and I enjoy a nice bowl of hot and sour soup now and then.
What's been the most rewarding part of getting these stories on paper?
The most rewarding part of getting these stories on paper, first of all, was to tell my father in a way that he could really relate, the written word, how special this period was for me living with him in the mid-1970s. I was sort of at a loss to where I fit. My mother had a new boyfriend. My oldest brother was moving into his own apartment. My middle brother, who had been at Boston University, was moving back in. And I wondered one day where I fit. And I didn't really see a room for myself in my mother's apartment. So my brother, Drew, my middle brother, said, why don't you move in with Dad? And my father happily let me move in. And that was the story for the next year and a half.
Well, and I gather he approves of the way you told it, given that he has contributed the foreword to this.
My father has been very supportive, as have all of my family members. No one has said, you can't write about that. Everyone's been very pleased. I think I've been honest and yet gracious. It's a memoir, so I'm writing my perspective on my childhood, and I have a pretty sunny view on what happened. And I think, as a trained reporter, I was a newspaper reporter my early part of my career, I was able to bring those objective reporting skills to train on my own childhood. So I felt honest. My father loves the stories. He loves the fact that I brought it back to life. He has written me a number of times saying that it's so much fun we had back in those days, and I'm so glad you were able to tell it.
Well, Kip Friedman, thank you so much for sharing this with us, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Kip Friedman's memoir is called Barracuda in the Attic. It's published by Fantagraphics Books. Our interview with him first aired last month, and you'll find a link to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then an exhibit shows that even when war disrupts a culture, making art doesn't stop. We'll learn about the Afghan war rugs next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Peace has been a fleeting concept for centuries in Afghanistan. The war the U.S. fought there came not long after the Soviet military occupation. At the turn of the 20th century, it was the British that fought in Afghanistan in a series of conflicts which they fought to defend what they saw as their interests in that Central Asian region. And even in the time in between, Afghanistan was not immune from war. But it was with the most recent wars in the background that the tradition of weaving war rugs emerged. The rugs depict everything from the occupiers themselves to maps to military equipment. An exhibit of Afghan war rugs is on display through early January at the Villa Terrace Decorative Arts Museum in Milwaukee. It's curated by private collector Enrico Mascheloni and by independent curator Anna Marie Sawkins. They spoke with us in October when the exhibit first opened, and Mascheloni talked about the rugs' broader significance.
The first thing to say is war rugs are absolutely traditional in technique. So what's striking is the representation, of course, because they started before the Afghan wars, as everybody knows, that started with the Soviet occupation in 1979. And in the first phase of their short history, because the history is short, it's a recent typology, the weapons were in the border or in no central point of the rug. They look like to come in the rug just in a silence way. But during the wars, and especially in the beginning of the 80s, they became central and in some cases, and especially now, exclusive. They are just weapon in the war rugs. Anyway, what we have to do with this exhibition, the choice we did with Anne-Marie was to present for the first time the different typologies of war rug. Because we consider war rug not only the rugs with weapons, with a prominent choice of, like a campionary of weapons. So we consider war rug also other representation, present something like a modernization of the traditional typologies. For instance, cityscape rug, and especially urban cityscape rugs.
So had Afghan rug makers in the past told stories in their rugs? This is just a modern manifestation of that?
They did. Yeah. The pictorial rugs start with, not in Afghanistan, but in Iran, with the attempt of modernization of the Qajari dynasty. They started at the end of 18th century until the First World War. They were striked from the European typologies that started to arrive also Persia, especially the French painting of 19th century. So there was something like a modernization, an attempt of modernization of the Central Asian rug with representation most of time with stories from the high Persian literature, like the Shahnameh from Ferdowsi, the Book of Kings, and the poetry of Nezami, things like this. For instance, the story of Majnun and Leila, and love tale, things like this.
So, Anna Marie, one of the things that makes all of these rugs so interesting is that they are predominantly made by women. Is that correct?
That is true, although I think increasingly there are also men involved in the process of weaving. But traditionally, it was always women that were weaving in the villages and among the nomadics.
So how did they get the information from outside? We always think of Afghan society, particularly tribal societies, being very closed, particularly for women, you know, that they don't see the outside world or aren't exposed to it very much. I mean, were people bringing in magazines, do you think?
In reality, I think it's a very visual culture, and that many Afghans are very keen observers. But there was also a lot of literature and images, postcards. I mean, Afghanistan has really been a center of trade and travel for centuries. It goes back to Genghis Khan and Alexander of Macedon or Alexander the Great. And so there's always been influences in the culture. And so using images from illustrations, postcards, propaganda, even U.S. propaganda, these all became source materials for rugs.
And Enrico, you were saying that the technique, however, is the same as it was centuries ago.
More or less the same.
So they're still hand weaving on a loom.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
And, yeah, the rugs are in fact knotted. You know, it's a knotting technique that's made on either a vertical or a horizontal loom.
And so are there different sizes of rugs in this collection that we're going to see here at the Villa Terrace?
Yes, they range from quite small, almost mat size, to larger. So I would say largely medium and small sized rugs. But there's one very large world map rug, which is just phenomenal and is presented in its own room.
Has its own space to take in. Yeah, I saw the representation of that, or the reproduction picture of that, and it looks fantastic.
Yeah. Oh. I think Bon is very important to point out that normally, as you know, rugs became famous even in Western country in the last years, not before. But people think, also people who is involved with this carpet for dealing or just to study them, they think there is just one typology, the representation of weapons. It's not true, because that one is just the one who is circulating in Western country. But as we told you before, there are the cityscape rug and many other rugs represent the attempt of representation of modernization, because differently from people say, Afghanistan wasn't an isolated country. It was a country in the center of a big traffic, as Anne-Marie said, because it was central in the Silk Way, for instance, not only in ancient time, but also in the 19th century. Of course, it was a very strong country against any kind of people who tried to come in, and especially for invaders. Right. They were the only one to gain a serious war against the British Empire.
Yeah, they won their independence quite early in the empire, you know, or the dissolution of the empire. They were, and I think somebody once said that Afghanistan was the place that, you know, nobody was really able to conquer. You know, they had their own ways of doing things, and they weren't going to put up with it. Yeah.
One of the things that people will see in many of the rugs in the exhibition are some of the major monuments in Afghanistan, such as the Minaret of Jam, and also, in addition to world maps, also maps of Afghanistan. And then major monuments like dams or bridges and cityscapes, as mentioned earlier, that might be either Western or even from North America.
How did this collection come to be? This is a group of private collectors that this all comes from?
Most of the rugs were bought in Central Asia, especially during the 80s and also the beginning of the 90s, when Kabul and the main Afghan cities were very difficult to visit. Because before the Soviet occupation and after the fight of Mujahideen groups immediately after the emirate of Taliban until 2001, so the main bazaar to find important war rugs was Peshawar in Pakistan. It's a borderline city. Now maybe it's more dangerous than Afghanistan, but at the time more or less it was possible to go there without big problems. And in the 80s was the main market. So most of the rugs come from Peshawar, but also other come from Herat, from Kabul, and even someone has been bought in Europe.
Okay, so they've come as far, they've traveled as far as Europe.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. As you know very well, Afghanistan in the 60s and 70s was the center point of the hippie trek to Asia. So the modernization of the country and especially the cityscape rug, this is my opinion, I haven't a sure proof, but probably come from the considering the interest also for from local dealer for this strange tourist.
Are these rugs still being made, or were these of a particular time and they are moving on to other kinds of expression in rug making?
No, they're still being made. Obviously, there's been some shifts in production area with rugs originally being made in Afghanistan and now often in refugee camps in Pakistan. And of course, the art is evolving at the same time, too.
In what way? How is it changing?
Well, it is a craft that's influenced by the market. So when there's interest in a certain type of rug, then the dealers will find more of that type of rug. So the weavers are responding to what's selling in the marketplace.
So is that a representation of a modernization of Afghanistan? Is that what makes these rugs important artistically?
Well, it's interesting because I think originally or initially it wasn't so much the dealers that were interested in these rugs. It was rather curators and contemporary art curators like Enrico, primarily because they were different and they represented a very sort of real and new expression. And of course, what fascinates me is the fact that you've got this centuries-old tradition butting against contemporary reality and contemporary society and really, in a way, very individualistic expression. So they're very refreshing. The dealers tended to concentrate more on the antique rugs and sort of high-quality, high-knot numbers and this and that, and overlooking sort of the freshness of this imagery.
So the fact that you've got these two traditions, as you said, butting up against each other, but the old tradition is absorbing all of this newness and moving forward,
absolutely,
which I would say probably makes it very exciting artistically.
We also thought it was very important to show the evolution of these rugs as well. So, you know, part of that is the newer examples, which have in many instances become very pop. I mean, we have representations of 9/11, for example. There are representations of U.S. currency, of banknotes in very small formats. And this is just really interesting because it's becoming the culture that's ubiquitous in and around Afghanistan. Of all the rugs that are being weaved, war rugs represent a very, very small percentage of what's being produced. So,
very important to this.
In that sense, they're rare. I mean, there are numerous examples and different variations on a theme that are interesting to track. But as a percentage of the entire rug output of Central Asia, for example, it's small.
Like 1%? Something like that?
I've heard 1%,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll have an opportunity throughout the next few months to be able to visit it. So I'm very much looking forward to that. I want to thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you to you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Enrico Mascheloni and Anna Marie Sawkins are curators of the exhibit Afghan War Rugs, The Modern Art of Central Asia. It's on display through early January at the Villa Terrace Decorative Arts Museum in Milwaukee. Our interview with them first aired in early October. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air is next.